So John 21 is the concluding epilogue of the Gospel of John. It's what scholars consider to be a natural conclusion to the end of chapter 20 with its explicit purpose statement. I'll read that now. John 20, verse 30. Now Jesus did this and many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. This is the big picture of John. And to be honest, John probably could have stopped there, right? But this epilogue still has some very beneficial teachings, some very beneficial application that I'm hoping to delve into a little bit today. Chapter 21 does not function as additional proof of Jesus' resurrection. We've seen that all the way from chapter 1 up through chapter 20. Instead, it's an address to the early church and its responsibilities in the world. This chapter shifts the focus to post-resurrection life of the disciples, particularly highlighting the restoration and recommissioning of Peter and clarifying the roles of the beloved disciple and other followers. It's a poignant narrative that reaffirms Jesus' ongoing care for his church, his instructions for their mission, and the diverse paths of discipleship. Through a miraculous catch of fish, a breakfast meeting by charcoal fire, intimate conversations, Jesus is equipping his followers for the future, reinforcing the core themes of love and witness, and providing a powerful final testament to his finished work and the enduring calling of his people. So what we see in chapter 21 is even after Jesus appeared to the disciples post-resurrection, and as Rick shared in the welcome, he says, "Peace be with you." "As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." He had already commissioned them to go out, spread the gospel. And yet, they're still kind of unsure of what to do. So Peter suggests they go fishing, which is his prior vocation. And after fishing all night on the Sea of Galilee without catching anything, Jesus appears unknowing to them, instructing them to cast their nets once more. And this time they catch so many fish that they have to drag the net to shore. This was the 8th miracle. However, it's not, I would say, of John's 7 miracles that he highlights that display Jesus' sovereignty. This is the kind of the epilogue miracle. The others being initial, Jesus turning water into wine, Jesus healing an official's son, John 4, Jesus healing the lame man at the pool of Bethesda, John 5, Jesus feeding the 5,000, John 6, Jesus walking on water and calming a storm, also John 6, Jesus healing a blind man from birth, Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and then Jesus raises himself. So that's this crescendo of miracles that we see throughout the Gospel of John. And then to come back, and it's like, Jesus, we're catching a bunch of fish again. It's the same Sea of Galilee that they fed the 5,000. So what do we make of this? Well, this is the final piece of evidence that John is showing us that Jesus is the Son of God. And Jesus is taking this opportunity to question Peter about his priorities. What happens next? Does Peter love Christ more than he loves fishing? In the same way that Peter denied Christ three times before his crucifixion, in this chapter, three times Peter will declare his love for Christ and be commissioned to him as the church's spiritual shepherd. In the last section of this chapter, Jesus talks with Peter about the details of Peter's death. And Peter, who is maybe easily distracted, asks Jesus about John, the author of this gospel. And Jesus kind of brings the focus back to Peter and is like, don't worry about John. Don't worry about John. Just focus on yourself. Jesus' words were misunderstood, and many of the disciples believed that maybe John wouldn't die, but Christ's point is that he could come back at any time. And so John closes his gospel by saying, again, that the works and evidence of Jesus Christ are true from his eyewitness testimony, and that if we were to account for all of the things Jesus did, it wouldn't be contained. It would just be infinite. The two pieces that I want us to walk away from this sermon are that Jesus is a living God of abundance, and Jesus is a loving God of grace. A living God of abundance and a loving God of grace. And then as we reflect on that, what is our response? Because that's the true purpose of this chapter. What is our response? So I'll start with reading verses 1 through 8. And please follow along with me in your Bibles. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. They said to him, we will go with you. They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? They answered him, no. He said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved, therefore, said to Peter, it is the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. This initial setting of the stage is pretty descriptive, not a lot of flowery narrative, but just, hey, this is where they were. What I keep thinking about when I'm reading this is, you know, just a week before, their Lord, their rabbi, was resurrected and had already appeared to them. And the roller coaster that they must have been on through this entire ministry to then, you know, they think Jesus is going to be an earthly king They're kind of talking amongst themselves as who's going to be the greatest of his, you know, maybe lords as he establishes his earthly kingdom. To then this bitter disappointment that, you know, he was crucified, that this light was taken from the world. And then to be back up on this high of he is who he said he was. He is God incarnate. And now we see this kind of like, let's go fishing. It doesn't really make sense for us on this side of the cross, but for them, you know, they didn't really have a concrete path forward. Simon Peter, as we call him, Peter, was a fisherman by trade before Jesus found him. And then Jesus said, you will be what? A fisher of people. So it kind of makes sense that he would go back to being a fisherman. I mean, the reality is they have to eat. All of these hopes and dreams that they had following their rabbi is now kind of on uneven ground, and they're not sure where to go. So the seven disciples that is mentioned, which is Simon Peter, or I'll refer to him from here out as Peter, Thomas, also known as Doubting Thomas, who just in the previous chapter, you know, physically confirmed that the resurrected Christ was who he said he was, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee. So we have James and John. John, son of Zebedee, is the author of this gospel. He's also refers to himself kind of in the third person as the most beloved disciple. We'll see that in this gospel as well. And two others. They decide to go fishing in the Sea of Tiberias, which is also the Sea of Galilee. It's quite a ways now from Jerusalem. If you look on a map of Israel and the Middle East, it's quite a ways north, with Tiberias being the largest city on the west coast. If you look at the Sea of Galilee like a clock, it's kind of 8 o'clock on the location. And they fish at night, which is customary for that time. Fishing at night so that anything that they catch, they can bring to market the next day to sell fresh. And they experience this just complete and utter failure. They catch nothing. So this setting emphasizes kind of their return to old ways before this new calling is established. As dawn breaks, Jesus stands on the shore, but the disciples don't recognize him. Highlighting the transformed nature of his body. I also think this highlights our spiritual recognition of Christ. Even if Jesus was here amongst us today, would we recognize him? Or would we fall back onto, I'll say, our more human instincts, that would be impossible? Jesus asks if they have any fish, and when they reply no, he instructs them, throw your net on this side, and you'll find some. It's almost comical to me that they actually did that if they didn't recognize him, instead of being like, who is this? Who is this guy? So they must have just been at such a wit's end that they're like, all right. They cast their nets on the side, and suddenly they catch such a large number of fish that the fact that the net stayed together was a miracle. It should have just burst at the seams. And it's at this point that the beloved disciple, which is John by inference, recognizes Jesus and exclaims to Peter, "It is the Lord." So it's interesting how I would say the giftings of the different disciples complement each other. Because John is the one that recognizes him, but Peter is the one that just is like dives right into the water. Just no holds bar. Reckless abandon when he hears that this is the Lord. So Peter, with his characteristic impulsiveness, throws on his outer garment and jumps into the sea to swim to Jesus. That was another thing I thought was interesting is, if we were at a birthday party that had a pool and there's somebody in the water, the classic trope is like, take off your outer garment and then jump in. But John did the opposite. He put on his coat and then jumped in. So just complete abandonment. It's a rich demonstration in both Jesus' sovereign power and immediate provision, even in this kind of seemingly mundane activity. They number the fish. They say 153 were caught. Let me read the next bit. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. The living Lord of abundance that I mentioned earlier, that Jesus is still amongst the disciples in the same way that he's still amongst us. It shows that their fruitfulness, although they were reverting to their old ways, their fruitfulness still is grounded in the Lord's providence and provision. That the call for these disciples was not going to be in self-sufficiency, but in spirit-empowered dependence. And so they come and have breakfast with Jesus. I will note that the use of charcoal fire here is only previously seen in chapter 18, right before Peter denies Christ for the third time. So John, in his illustration, is already kind of setting the stage for this beautiful, poetic restoration. And Jesus invites them to bring some of the fish that they caught and join him for breakfast. He then takes the bread and the fish and gives it to them. And this is in the same general area as the feeding of the 5,000. So also kind of a full circle moment. And we see this kind of wonderful display of just amazing ordinariness of the Christian life. Resurrection, it didn't completely change our lives here on earth. We are still living out our day-to-day with needing to eat, having to labor, the struggle against sin, disease, suffering. But there is this added intimacy and meaning that Jesus is the living God of abundance, providing for his followers. The next verses, 15 through 17. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he had said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." The first two times in this interaction, Jesus uses the Greek word translated agape, which is this higher, sacrificial, unconditional love. And then in the original Greek, Peter responds with phileo, where Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, is derived from, which is a strong attraction or brotherly love. And in the third question, Jesus switches to that same verb, phileo, and Peter is grieved that Jesus asks a third time, indicating his sorrow over his three denials. I think Peter, you know, each time he's like, "Jesus, you know, kind of what's this question and response charade? I can't hide anything from you. Yes, I love you." But he's still broken about the previous confirmed prophecies that he would deny Jesus as his Christ three times before the rooster crows. Each time, Jesus responds to Peter's affirmation of love with a commission, a direction. He says, "Feed my lambs. Take care of my sheep. Feed my sheep." This exchange directly mirrors and reverses Peter's three denials, serving as his restoration and recommissioning as a shepherd of Christ's flock. Jesus restores him not by ignoring the failure, but by redeeming it. He doesn't ask about Peter's competence. He's not like, "What did you learn? Have you learned your lesson?" But he's inquiring as to Peter's love. Because our ministry doesn't flow from talent or knowledge, but from a Christian's love of Christ. And grace doesn't erase failure, but redeems it. And so this is where we see Jesus Christ as our loving God of grace. So living God of abundance and loving God of grace. Because what Jesus wants most is not performance. He wants a love, not the what, but the why. Feeding his sheep is an outworking of love And love for Jesus fuels our ministry. The next verses, 18 through 25, we see Peter's destiny, and then again, this beloved disciple's future, which is John. Follow with me. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." I'll pause here before I go on to verses 20 through 25, but one piece of context that I think is interesting with the Gospel of John is when it was written. This is written towards the end of John's life. And so the other Gospels already exist. The book of Acts and the early church is already well on its way. And John has lived this kind of long life. And his gospel is this beautiful supplement to the other testimonies that are already out there. And so John's writing this at a point where Peter has already died a martyr's death. And he's reflecting back on the fact that, you know, Jesus told Peter this would happen. And he says, "Follow me." We don't follow God because it's easy. We follow Jesus Christ because he led where no one else could go. As that sacrificial lamb, the incarnate Son of God, he was not aloof from us in some kind of, you know, this universal power that we like to think is, or other religions would say is impersonal. Our God is deeply personal, deeply loving, to the point that he will sacrifice himself for us. And so he's calling Peter to do nothing less than he has already done for us, and tells Peter to follow me, meaning following Jesus even unto death. The next verses then highlight what we'll see as John's future. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that the disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. So again, after Jesus commands Peter to follow him, Peter's kind of looking around. And he's like, what about this guy? And Jesus is pretty sharp when he says, just worry about yourself. Don't concern yourself with how all of the other disciples will be used. Emphasizing that each disciple, each apostle, and I'll extend it, each follower of Christ has a unique calling and destiny. So Peter should focus on his own. I'd be lying to stand up here and say, I don't compare myself to others. I think we can all relate to that. I think we waste time and energy worrying about others' assignments, others' status at work. But Christ says that your call is obedience. And so our focus should be to him and worry less about how we stack up with each other. And then John clarifies this popular misconception within the early church, stating that Jesus did not say that this beloved disciple, that John, would not die, and corrects the misinterpretation that he would remain alive until Jesus' return. There must have been, on the outflowing of the growing of the church, you know, just 1,000 different theories on what was going to happen to the apostles. They're seeing some of them be martyred. People thought John is now immortal. And John, as he's writing this gospel in his old age, may have been near death and clarifying that that was not Jesus' intent. And then the chapter concludes with this explicit affirmation of the author's identity and veracity, that this is a disciple who testifies to these things and wrote him down. We know that his testimony is true. All of this scripture is a gift to us from God in the veracity in these eyewitness accounts of the good news. And then the last verse reminds us that this gospel is selective. It's not an exhaustive list of everything. We can pull out different pieces from the different gospels. We can pull out different pieces from the epistles. And the reality of Jesus is inexhaustible. So John 21 closes the gospel with intimacy and mission. Jesus is risen. He's glorified. Yet here he is, enjoying a simple breakfast with his disciples, restoring and redeeming the failures of Peter and sending out his disciples. So what is our response? Jesus is the living God of abundance. He's a loving God of grace. And our mission is to remain in obedience to his word. You know, it's easy to get lost in both the magnitude of the universe and feel insignificant, as well as get distracted by the things happening immediately to us that feel like, you know, barriers that nobody else has ever had to overcome. And I was struck this week with, if anybody has been following the Artemis II mission and the astronauts that went around the moon, and what struck one of the astronauts, which was Christina Cook, wasn't necessarily looking back on Earth as it's just getting smaller and smaller in the rearview window, so to speak. She said, but all the blackness around it. She said, Earth was just this lifeboat hanging undisturbingly in the universe. And she said, there's one thing I know, and that is planet Earth, you are a crew. Now, as a Christian, I view all of these things through a Christian lens. And one of the things that it makes me think of is Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. I just can't help but be overwhelmed by the vastness of the universe. And we're here on this little oasis in the middle of it with an opportunity at life. And so it's easy to have that and think, like, I'm so small. And then on this opposite side, think, how can we be, each of us, be empowered that God has a plan for each and every one of you? He's the master of all time and space, and yet he has divinely designed each of you and placed you at this exact moment in time for a reason. And so how do we respond to just the enormity of that? Well, probably like the disciples on the boat. They didn't recognize him at first. And if Jesus was sitting in our church right now, we probably wouldn't recognize him. But when we do recognize him, we jump in with reckless abandon and say, Lord, you are Lord of my life, and I'm willing to follow you. So I would encourage, as we all walk in this path of faith, to start with prayer, to tune our ears to God calling us, and even though our lives are brief, we don't know if we'll be remembered or not. Focus on the one thing that we can control, that which is make your life about the gospel and leave the rest up to God. We can't control the results. We can't even measure the success of what we accomplish. But we can do one thing, and that's stay faithful. I'll leave the rest up to God, who will do an infinitely better job than we ever could.